I do think it's helpful in our sermons to be able to kind of have categories like that, whether we call it theological triage or not, just to recognize some things will be more important than others to emphasize. And there may be, you know, you, especially if you're preaching sequentially through books of the Bible, there's going to be passages that reference something that is not a hill to die on. You know, you'll be preaching through Revelation, and you may get to some details in there that it's like, this is not something I want us to divide over how we interpret this.
Hi, and welcome to the Expositors Collective Podcast. This is episode 154, and I'm your host, Mike Neglia. Well, you're about to hear a conversation that I got to have with Dr. Gavin Ortlund. He is the pastor of First Baptist Church in Ojai, California. He also is a prolific author. And in this conversation, we mention and speak about a little bit his book that came out in 2020 called Finding the Right Hills to Die On, The Case for Theological Triage. So we speak about some of the implications of theological triage in pulpits around the world. If you're not sure what that is, well, just listen to the podcast. We also speak about dialogical preaching. Like, how is it possible to communicate back and forth? Whether we're able to physically ask questions and hear answers, or if we're still preaching to a video camera in isolation, how can we make it as dialogical as possible? And there also, guys, there's some gold about preaching application. How can we apply the truth to real life on the ground situations? I think that part of the conversation really shines. So if you, like me, struggle with application, then I believe you really are going to enjoy that section of the conversation. Okay, I'm going to chime in again at the end. But thanks again to Dr. Gavin for his time, and I hope all of you enjoy listening to this. I hope that this conversation, this podcast, and all that we do at the Expositors Collective helps you to grow in your personal study and your public proclamation of God's Word. Well, hey, welcome to the Expositors Collective Podcast. I'm here with Dr. Gavin Ortlund, and thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Well, I'm really excited. I've been looking forward to this for quite a long time. As soon as I was going to say as soon as I finished your book, The Right Hills to Die On, but actually it was like kind of on chapter two that I said, I really want to see if I'm able to talk to Gavin about some of this. So we'll talk about some of that content probably later on, but just I'm excited. Thank you so much.
Oh, it's my pleasure. Yeah, I'm looking forward to it.
Well, and here's my first question. Let's just get right into it. We always ask this as the first question. Can you tell us about the very first time that you have preached the Bible? When was your first sermon? How did it go? Can you bring us to that probably awkward moment of your life?
Yeah, I'm sure you've heard some horror stories as you ask this question to different folks. Yeah, mine were definitely not good. But they weren't also, you know, horror stories, but I just remember, I think I'd given a few like talks at my youth group earlier than this, but my first actual sermon, I think I was a first year seminary student and there was a church nearby that had a need. I guess they were very desperate and they, kind of allowed some seminary students to, and I did two back-to-back sermons and I can't remember what the first one was on. I know the second one was on Revelation 21 and the idea of heaven. And yeah, they were, it was a very gracious church. They were very kind to put up with me and give me a chance. Yeah, I just remember feeling so formal. And as I think back on then, I can't help but be embarrassed at just kind of how methodical and formal it was, just having never preached before. You know, I worked so hard to plan it all out and because I wanted to do a good job. But some of the basic mechanics I are similar to how I still preach today. So it wasn't just an, you know, rambling, incoherent sermon. But yeah, I think that the thing that I noticed the most when I think back on that is just the delivery and just kind of the heart of it. feeling so formal and so stale back then. So it is sort of painful to, in fact, it's painful even to listen to sermons I preached, you know, 5 years ago, because we're constantly growing and learning. But those ones are especially painful.
Yeah, okay. So Revelation 21 and 22 for the second one, was that right?
And you know, it was just Revelation 21, the first seven verses of Revelation 21.
And I'm going to assume that the first one wasn't Revelation 20. You weren't sequentially working your way through the end of Revelation, were you? Was it two different separate topics?
No, I didn't start off my first sermon ever preaching on hell, thankfully. Yeah. Thankfully. I don't remember what that first one was. I think it was on the passage in Hebrews 10 about perseverance. Hebrews 10, 19 through 25. I think that's right.
Hey, I'm glad that we were here for the retrieval of that from your memory.
It's such a painful memory. I had repressed it in my mind.
So, okay. So it sounds like your structure sounds that you're happy enough with the structure.
Yeah.
And the content you're happy with as well. But the heart was lacking, you're saying?
Yeah, the content was okay, I think, maybe, you know, because I was in seminary at that time. I went to Covenant Seminary in St. Louis. I loved Covenant. And one of the things they really hammer away at you is the homiletics classes and how to put together a sermon, how to think through a passage with the different elements of a sermon, explanation, illustration, application. Is it a two-point sermon or a three-point sermon or something else? What's the main idea of the sermon? So I had a lot of that hammered into me. So I approached it with, I think, you know, it had some good structure, but yeah, the thing I noticed the most is just how much I've learned you have to speak in a natural way from your heart, and it can't feel like a formal lecture or something that is just so methodical and stale. That's what I noticed the most when I think back, not only on that, but a lot of my preaching in those early seasons of my ministry.
Okay. Well, that goes like quite easily into the second question, which is, I mean, how have you grown since then, or how do you hope that you've grown since then over the past, how many years ago was that? 10, 15?
Yeah, that would have been, 13 years or so ago. Yeah, so it's been a lot of change since then. Yeah, I definitely have changed a lot, I think. It's interesting. I actually think in some ways I work less hard than I did for those, because those I was nervous and it was a big thing. It was like the two sermons I was doing that whole summer. So I put a lot of work into it. And I've kind of learned in some ways that you can't overdo it in a sermon. Like a sermon should really be making one point, and there's a lot that a sermon can't do. And sometimes it's easy, especially when you're starting off, to try to overdo it in terms of just the content. You try to cram into it or how much detail you might go into. So in some ways, I think I've gotten a little more relaxed. I think one of the ways I think I've changed is with my applications. I remember listening to Tim Keller gave a talk at the Gospel Coalition on preaching from the heart a couple years ago. And one of the things he said about application from the text is, imagine you're in the counseling room and talking with one individual. What do you say to them, you know, and make it really direct and really personal? And I think as I think back on my early sermons, I worked really hard on explaining the text. I worked really hard on illustrations too, but that the applications were just so trite and simplistic and not really helpful to people who might be suffering or struggling. And I think one of the things I'm sure I'll keep growing in this, but I think I've grown in a little bit, is just trying to have application that can feel authentic to the real struggles of life and that can hit different kinds of struggles. You know, so I'm often thinking in my sermon prep, I have kind of a grid that I go through for different kinds of sort of demographics that might be present. So children, non-Christians, those are some basic ones where you've got to have something for the kids and something for the non-Christians who are present. You have to acknowledge their presence in some way, and everyone benefits from the acknowledgement of those peoples. And then another kind of grid I always go through is, how do I do application differently for the soft-hearted person versus the hard-hearted person? And I just find it helps me to factor that in, because some people are in a very different spot. Some people are sitting there, and the moment you mention something, they're convicted. And they're saying, oh, I need to repent, you know, and they need they need grace. And others are sitting there saying, arms folded, leaning back, saying, you know, maybe distracted or even just opposing the message, perhaps. And you have to factor that in and try to speak to both groups. So that's those kinds of things I think I've grown a lot in terms of applying the text.
Wow. I'd love to ask more about that grid. So is it an actual like document or is it kind of a mental grid?
It's an actual document. I don't always look at the actual document. I've kind of memorized it or at least the main ones. And yeah, I just go through and with my applications, of course, I don't try to be heavy-handed or explicit about it, you know? So sure. A lot of times it'll be
and now, like, children, it is your turn. I will address you now, child. Now, hard-hearted, you're next.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. This next point is for the hard-hearted out there. But it's trying to be subtle. But, you know, so for example, I don't know, maybe the sermon is on, Sabbath rest, finding rest in God or something like that. And I might say, you know, for some of us, just the mention of this topic brings up feelings of guilt because we realize we have not been doing this well and we're checking our phone first thing in the morning. We haven't taken a day off in forever. And we just feel that conviction. And here's how this might apply for us if we're in that category. But I know for others of us, we may be thinking, you know, that's really not a problem for me. I don't really struggle with that. And then you have to reason with that kind of person. So that's kind of how I approach it in terms of just acknowledging the feelings in the room.
Wow. Well, that's wise. And again, if you use something like that again and again, then there's not the need to consult the printed thing. But that's just good pastoring and good connection to the congregation. I also want to come back. You said that you mention or you address unbelievers, and you said that everyone benefits from that. Could you explain like why everyone benefits from that?
Yes, I think there's several reasons. One is that it models evangelism for folks if it's done well, because they are then hearing, oh, that's how we might, you know, if we're doing like apologetics. Sometimes I'll have an apologetics sidebar in a sermon. Sometimes that will be a relatively lengthy, like 2 or 3 minute kind of tackling an objection. You know, you might say, you know, a lot of us in our culture really struggle with this idea that God judges people. And there's actually some reasons why we might try to make sense of that. And here they are, you know, and you go into it. But another thing I might do with that is just sheer acknowledgement. People can hear you better if they feel as though their concerns matter. And so simply if in some cases, if I don't have time, I might simply say, you know, I know a lot of us really struggle with what this passage says about judgment. And that's a really tough topic. Here's a resource you might look if you want to chase that down a little more. Boom. And then you've just acknowledged it. And at least someone feels like you've given them some oxygen. Yeah. And then the other reason I think addressing unbelievers is helpful is because it reminds everyone that church is not just for Christians. The public worship assembly is not restricted to Christians. Then someone might be in the pew sitting there thinking, oh, I want my neighbor so-and-so to come hear this. And it just reinforces a culture that's more open to people visiting.
Yeah, so not using exclusively insider language. While again, much of what we say has to do with us and, you know, the body of Christ, yet specifically addressing those that are outside. So maybe one final question on that end. What if there's not any unbelievers in the room? What if you, like, you know, you've been following Richard Baxter, you've catechized everybody, you know that everyone's regenerate. Should you still address unbelievers when they're not in the room?
Well, I still do it. I mean, I don't know. Our church is big enough that there's people there on Sundays I don't know. But even if I was in a situation where I knew everybody, I think it could still be done in a relatively non-awkward way. It might just be phrased as, you know, as we gather each week, very often, I don't know how I'd word this exactly, but I might just say something along the lines of, some of us who are here may struggle, may feel this way about it, or at least we know people who do. But some sensitivity to that, some acknowledgement of that, I think is good. The other thing, just real quick on the grid, is it's not just people, it's also spheres of life. So I try to, again, because my applications used to be so trite and kind of like they all boil down to just basically love Jesus, which in a sense, actually, isn't that bad. Because if you're going to focus on something, that's but so now I try to think about families and marriages, have something about that in the applications, something about you as a parent or as a single person or as a brother or sister or as a child or as an aunt or uncle, something in that sphere, vocation and work, and then something both individual and corporate. Because what I find is if I don't think in those categories, all my applications tend to be the same. And it helps me to force myself to say, what does this mean for us as a church? What does this mean for us as individual citizens of our country? What does it mean for us in our prayer life? And just, you know, fleshing it out in those concrete ways.
Oh, man, that sounds great. Do you find that with such, I don't want to say exhaustive, because that implies A, that it's exhausting, or then B, that you've pulled every possible application out, and you actually haven't. But with a quote unquote exhaustive look at the application, do you find that it's harder to get through versus if there's going to be more potential application? Do you find that your pericopes are getting shorter and shorter?
I try to just cut it off when it gets to the brim. So, I mean, I should clarify, the grid isn't something like every application is doing every category. It's more just an awareness so that there's something in the sermon. And there may be exceptions to that. There may be a week where I don't address the kids or I don't address, you know, it's not a legalistic thing, but I do try to keep it regulated. And I do try to keep, I don't do this because I think you have to, but just for me, it's been helpful to think in those buckets of explanation, illustration, application. And I'm not legalistic about that, but I've just found it personally helpful. So I try to keep those relatively even in terms of each main point.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'm sorry to drill down so deep. You have much more to say than just that, but that really is exciting to me. And I think that our hearers, you know, some of whom have, you know, even communicated that application doesn't come naturally to them. And like even what you were saying, kind of defaulting back to some of those same application points, you know, well, you know, church, what a reminder, you got to read your Bible every day, or, you know, it's really important to pray, you know, but there's more to say than only those. And so I think you've given us some tools to maybe see the text through different eyes. I'm rereading Brian Chappell's book, Christ-Centered Preaching, at the moment. And he references like having like imaginary people sitting at his desk, or rather having real people. He's imagined that they're at his desk. So he writes the sermon with a few congregation members, you know, seated around him and saying, how could I help that person? What does this text say to that lady?
Mm-hmm. Yes, I think that's really helpful. I do that even while I'm preaching. I'll focus on individuals so that you're speaking to individuals, not just to a general mass of people. And by the way, let me just recommend the book you just mentioned. It's been so helpful for me that people might find that helpful. Brian Chappell's Christ-Centered Preaching. It's sort of a one-stop shop for me. I mean, just in terms of how to structure a sermon and the theology of a sermon. So I really recommend that book to people.
Yeah, I mean, a new edition came out somewhat recently, and so that's the one that I'm going through. And usually if a book comes out second edition and I have the first, it's like, oh, that's oh well. But this one, I'm like, no, I want to see what he's added and clarified. So yes, wholeheartedly, great, great book. One day, if anyone's listening to this and knows Brian Chappell, please connect me. I want to interview him on this show, and I won't say anything. I'll just say, Brian, would you just talk to us? Tell us whatever you think we should know. Well, on the topic of maybe like growth or progression, I'm not sure how to ask this question really, but in a smooth transition. But your book on finding the right hills to die on, like, speaks about something that you call like theological triage. Is that something that you've like grown in as a preacher? Is this something that you think that as preachers are maturing, that they should have an awareness of this concept of theological triage?
Well, I do think it's helpful in our sermons to be able to kind of have categories like that, whether we call it theological triage or not, just to recognize some things will be more important than others to emphasize. And there may be, you know, especially if you're preaching sequentially through books of the Bible, there's going to be passages that reference something that is not a hill to die on. You know, you'll be preaching through, heck, Revelation. And you may get to some details in there that it's like, this is not something I want us to divide over how we interpret this. You know, some people see this imagery this way, others in that way. So that can be done, I think, very smoothly without too many, nerdy theology terms, by simply saying, in this verse we hear this referenced, and this is a tough topic that Christians have disagreed upon. One of the views is A. Another one of the views is B. And we're not in this sermon going to take a position on that, but if you're interested in pursuing that more, here's something you might look into. You know, and you can just flag. And I think that kind of thing is often wise. It models the ability to make those kinds of distinctions, which unfortunately many Christians don't do that well. We see kind of everything at the same level of importance. So I think that can be really helpful in our sermons to do it, whether we do it exactly that way or not. I do think we have to differentiate between sort of the main point of the passage and some of the little details.
Yeah. Yeah, you know, I often, there's a lot of things that I've made mistakes in, preaching-wise, ministry-wise, life-wise. But one thing, and I hate to kind of toot my own horn, this is something that like has been a part of my preaching for decades, for almost as long as I have been preaching. As I mentioned to you before we started recording, I've pastored a church in Ireland, which has a very, very low evangelical presence, about 1 or 2%. And so churches like mine and churches, you know, that value these things are so very rare. And so it means that we pull in people from all kinds of different backgrounds with different expectations, and from the very early days have had a diverse congregation, both ethnically and then also heritage and Catholic and Protestant upbringings. And so to be able to say, hey, listen, there's certain things and they're just the most important thing. And there's other things that we're not all going to agree on in the same room. In those early replanting days have been very, very helpful and very, very useful. And I can't imagine taking a hill to die on some of these smaller issues. I think it could have just, you know, torpedoed the church from the very early age, or just destroyed things, really. But sadly, some people do that.
Yeah. Yeah. I love what you're saying. I mean, I think just the general heart behind the whole idea of triage is just, we want the gospel to be the focus. And it's really easy to become feisty about things other than the gospel. And so the basic instinct is kind of a healthy, balanced mentality about theology. And I think preaching is one way we can probably help with that. I don't think preaching is kind of the main way I think about teaching that. I think about in membership classes and elders meetings and other levels like that, we can get into it. But preaching, hopefully we can model it there.
Yeah. I heard Mark Driscoll explain it maybe 13, 14 years ago. He talked about open-handed issues and closed-handed issues, and you know, said that the problem of liberals is that both are open, that there's the deity of Christ and all those kind of what you'd call first-tier issues, and there's the open-handed issues, which are those secondary or tertiary issues. And he'd say liberals have both hands opened. Anything's up for grabs. Fundamentalists have both hands closed. They'll fight you on the small or the big because it all is equally as important. And I use that illustration so many times, like in elders meetings, in membership meetings, in the occasional sermon. And it was this constant kind of vocabulary of the church. And it actually just thrilled me when in the early days I saw a member of the church speaking to like a visitor or a new person. And then I could see her from like across the room, and she had one hand open and one hand closed. And she was, you know, opening and closing both, and just seeing, wow, this vocabulary has kind of like seeped its way through. And then now it's being, you know, again, I heard it on a podcast. I made it my own because I said it so much. And then to see it communicated to somebody else as, this is, we have certain things that are important. Let me tell you about what's most important to us. And there's other things that we're willing to disagree on.
That's great. Yeah, it's always encouraging as a pastor when you see something you said being reiterated. You think, okay, something is getting through to folks.
Yeah, and Gavin, that might be the only time that's ever happened. But I happened to see it, and I was like, yes. I felt good about that. Have you heard Gary Beshears? He has what he calls the four D's, which is maybe similar to your work.
Yes. Yeah, it's very similar. Different terms, but basically they map on pretty much exactly, I think, if I recall. So my categories are fourfold, and this is from Al Mohler and others, and it's not all that original, but just first rank issues or would be like the Trinity. They define orthodoxy. Second rank issues might be something like baptism. It might divide us one church to another, but it's not. It doesn't make you a Christian. Third rank issues are important, but they don't need to be divided over. So I argue like the views of some of the details of the end times, and fourth rank issues are just things that don't matter at all. So that's similar to Gary Beshears. You'd have to remind me. I could try to do them from memory, but
I have them written down, so you don't have to. Yeah, he speaks about there's certain things that we die for. There's certain things that we divide over. There's certain things we debate about. And then there's things that we decide for. And your decision about this doesn't really impact my decision about this. Starting from the bottom and then the top, it's I literally would give my life because this is so important to me. Yeah, so it's not, you know, you're quick to say this idea didn't originate with you. But again, I'm so glad that it's getting so much traction because of your book. And it's given people some vocabulary to articulate this, I think, in a very helpful way that keeps us from being, pugnacious, argumentative, needlessly antagonistic to one another. And then for those of us that are teaching and preaching, setting culturals of argumentation. Again, thank you. I really do appreciate it.
Oh, thanks for saying that. I hope it's helpful to people. I wrote the book for real pastors. We talked about how a lot of my other books are more academic. This one was just, for on-the-ground realities of ministry, pastors, elders, seminary students, and just hoping it'd be helpful for people because we live in such a polarizing time. I mean, it does seem as though we're losing the ability to sort of disagree graciously and disagree in a way that acknowledges the complexity of the issues at hand and kind of thinks carefully about the level of importance of various issues. So hopefully the book will be helpful, particularly because of those cultural dynamics right now.
Yeah. Yeah. I'd love to hear about like your sermon prep routine. But before we kind of leave this topic, if I might ask more of a personal question. So how does this idea like work itself out at the Ortland family dinner table? I know that, that your brothers, your parents, they're all in a different denomination than you are. Or I think your one brother is a Anglican and then the rest are Presbyterians, if I'm correct. And you're the solitary Baptist, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. When you first asked about that, because with my kids, I have a soon-to-be 8-year-old, 6-year-old, 3-year-old, and 10-month-old. And so when you first said Ortland family dinner table, I was picturing because we're putting a lot of work on like talking during dinner and like trying to talk about our day and that kind of thing. So I was saying, we're not quite to theological triage yet.
Yeah, family of origin, I should have distinguished, yes.
Yeah. No, and with my family, honestly, it hasn't really been something that's been a major source of conversation. I remember when I first became Baptistic, I did talk to my dad about that because he had been the one who baptized me. And he was just very gracious and just, I think, his focus was just saying, if you are following your conscience and following Christ, that is what I care about. And he actually sent me an article about Spurgeon when Spurgeon made that same movement. So he was even sort of not encouraging me in a way, but just, so yeah, it's never been like there's never really been anything personal like that. I think my oldest two siblings are both Anglican. Dane, my next brother, is a Presbyterian minister now. And my dad is in the Acts 29 network and planted a independent Acts 29 church. So yeah, we're in different sort of networks, I suppose, but I don't know, we're pretty similar at heart, so this hasn't really been a personal thing or a big topic that's come up a great deal. For me, it's just been more personal in as navigating as a pastor and just the challenges of,
just the extremes you see on both sides, where some people have seen such ugliness and feistiness, and they're reacting against a kind of harsh conservative upbringing or context that they were in. And so they really lunge in the other direction toward kind of a minimalistic attitude of just saying less. They just don't like theology at all. And then others in the opposite way, they've seen the dangers of liberalism and they're really concerned about right doctrine. And sometimes people who go in that direction can be undersensitive to the importance of unity, the importance of being able to kind of negotiate differences without it destructing our gospel unity and ministry. So it's just easy to go in one direction or the other. And I've just seen this issue. I mean, this book didn't really come out of a theoretical place for me. It just came out of seeing the on-the-ground impact it has when we're either too tight or too loose.
Yeah, and regarding your family of origin, I expected exactly what you said. I couldn't imagine this this tearing your family apart anyway. And so now the promised question. So could you maybe talk us through like your weekly rhythm? So Sunday is coming and you have a sermon to prepare. What is your week look like leading up to it?
Yeah, I'll be getting into it right after we're done talking a little bit. So it's right
is
in my mind right now.
Okay. I won't keep you too long.
No. I've got plenty of time for this. But typically it varies a little bit, but typically what I try to do, and like I said earlier, it's actually gotten less hours as I've, not because I put less work into it. I think I've just learned how to move a little more quickly now. But typically what I do is on Monday or Tuesday, I just take a quick glance at the passage, finalize that is the passage, that I'm not going to make any changes to the preaching schedule, read it through, and just maybe jot down. Usually the only intention I have is just to become familiar with it. Sometimes lately I find I start thinking already like about an outline or about the main ideas. But the only intention with that is just a quick 15 minutes, just a quick, so that I'm not going into my later prep in the week cold, but I've had some time that it's been stewing in my mind a little bit. And that way when I'm running into people or situations, there might even be something that comes to me that's connected to it. So it's just there percolating throughout the week. And usually all I'm trying to do there is just maybe, it might even just be one word or one sentence. I'm just trying to get kind of where is this going? And then for me, the way it works is just on Thursday and Saturday mornings, I just, Friday's my day off. And I kind of have found, I don't know if this is good or not, but I kind of have found that Saturday, the day before, kind of works well for me because it's so fresh then the next day. So Thursday and Saturday mornings, I take some time. Thursday is kind of more preparatory. I'm not necessarily like writing the sermon. I'm just more sort of diving in to the passage, trying to come up with a structure, basic ideas, basic content. It's a little more focused on the text. Saturday is a little more focused on kind of polishing the actual sermon. So that's where like the introduction and conclusion might come in, for instance. So that's how it works for me. It's not a lot of hours actually anymore. I mean, maybe 8 to 10 hours. So it used to be more than that, but that's kind of the weekly rhythm.
Yeah, and I find that there's a cumulative nature to this as well. When it comes to even Bible knowledge, or when you study for a sermon, or when you do a deep dive into something, like you don't forget it. Like it's still kind of there, and so you're able to kind of draw back on the past 13, 14 years of study and sermon writing, and of course just Christian discipline. That being said, too, I know that you're also hitting the books and working hard in those 8 to 10 hours.
That's right, and I've just found that as time goes by, I'm able to more quickly see where to go with something. Whereas in my early years of preaching, it took me a little while to know, what do I do with this passage? Whereas now I've got some grooves that my mind starts to think in terms of just the centrality of the gospel, how a passage will relate to the gospel. So that's an encouragement for preachers out there, is just, as the years go by, you start to build more and more rhythm in how you approach the task.
Yeah, and the Saturday morning thing, I'm gonna quote Calvin to you, but Calvin and Hobbes. I don't know. Did you grow up with Calvin and Hobbes as well?
Oh yeah.
There's a clip, or there's one where I think Calvin is like playing in the play in the sand pit, and his mom or something says that he has like homework that he has to do, or he has a big paper to write, or whatever. And he's like, he said to Hobbes, "You know, I always wait until the right mood strikes me." And what's that right mood? Well, it's last minute panic. And I've found that the last minute panic also just like shoots this adrenaline through you. And well, I don't advocate, you know, Saturday night specials or early Sunday mornings, but there is something too that's like, well, I'm not just mulling this over anymore. There's purpose to this. And this is not just one day, but this is like tomorrow. So something's have got to come together at this point.
That's right. Yeah, I know. I've actually thought of that exact Calvin and Hobbes strip in relation to this point of the motivation of last minute panic. Really? He says like something like motivation. You can't turn on motivation like a faucet. You have to wait for the right mood. And then, yeah, last minute panic. Yeah. I mean, of course, that could be abused by someone.
Of course.
That could be, you know, but yeah, I don't know. I mean, to me, I agree with you, because it's like there is kind of this healthy dynamic of you feel the pressing urgency. In some respects, that is a helpful ingredient, because you're actually thinking about, oh, I'm going to be preaching tomorrow to that person and this person. And it does sort of influence the way you approach the preparation.
Yeah. Yeah. And I'm in a weird, you know, situation. As we've mentioned, in Ireland, there's a really crazy lockdown. Our church hasn't met in person for quite a long time. So you're about to start your sermon prep today, which is Wednesday. Today's Thursday. I actually am going to preach my sermon after this as well. So I have to go to my living room. You've been there, you know. You know, just go sit in alone in a room, look in the camera, and try to like muster up, you know, to do it all over again. And I've found it actually gets harder, not easier, the longer it goes. This totally disembodied preaching to people that you haven't seen in a long time, and you do hope that it connects. So, as the challenge of connecting it to real life to real people in their real lives, that's hard no matter what. And I found in 2020, and then for me anyway, into 2021, it's all the harder to make those connections.
I found the same thing. I was doing my recorded sermons. I think I mentioned this to you before, just separate, just for anybody who wasn't able to make it. And then in addition to our outdoor, we're meeting outdoors right now, and we're just sort of changing from that now and putting it out by radio. So it's all just the live one going out. But yeah, for a while I was fine with that. The pre-recorded thing, I was feeling fatigue after about 6 months. And it's just something about, as you say, the disembodied, disconnected thing. And I just had to remind myself, this is, I guess, an encouragement for anyone out there listening to this who feels that way, is that that's a totally normal feeling. It won't be like this forever, Lord willing. And just reminding yourself that it really is another person on the other end, and that they may really need to hear what you have to say each time. That is helpful along the way.
Yeah. Yeah. And for some people, they're actually really looking forward to it, you know, because they've had a hard week and they want to hear from their pastor. And so, yeah. So this is a pep talk that I'm giving myself, because again, I have to go preach John 15 downstairs in my living room to nobody, but it's not to nobody. It's to, you know, this church, these people who I know and love. I just, you know, can't see them right now. Here's a final question. I didn't send this to you in advance, so this one you can opt out if you want.
No,
but this question is: how are you currently trying to improve in your preaching?
Yeah, well, this is something that's very interesting, because since we're meeting outside. So because of the current state of the world, we're recording this in February of 2021.
Thanks for that marker, yeah.
we're meeting outside. We're meeting out of our, although we'll be moving back in sometime soon. But yeah, so what I've found is that there's a lot of distractions outside, and it actually has changed the way that I preach. There's cars driving by. There's a couple of times a pine cone has fallen out of the tree and hit someone while they're sitting under the tree.
I hear that can actually be lethal. I've heard people die from that.
Oh gosh. Yeah. Thankfully it has not caused any injuries, but, it is distracting and it is kind of funny. And then there's a house right across the way where their kids are playing in the front yard sometimes. And so there's just noise, just noise and distractions and things. And I've found that it is more challenging. I don't know if it's just in my head or if it's in actuality, but it feels like people's attention wanders more. Now, it might just be, this is another thing I've learned as a preacher, is that don't assume you know what they're thinking based on their body language. They can be sitting there with their arms crossed and their head down, looking mad or looking asleep, and actually the Holy Spirit is touching them in a way that you just cannot see. Or they can be look like it's great, and then you realize, ooh. So it's so important not to assume that I know what someone is thinking simply because of their body language. And that's so I take that to heart. Nonetheless, I do feel that the dynamics of being outside are very different. So I have become even more conversational and dialogical in my sermons. And, you know, we have about 60% of our people coming. So we've got about 80 or so outside. And it is small enough that I can do that. I can actually have a conversation. And it has really changed my preaching, I think, for the better. So I'll pause at key moments of the sermon. I have to think very carefully about what the question will be so that it's a helpful question and that it's a specific focused question that isn't just totally open-ended. But and I do this probably. Some weeks I do it not at all. Most weeks I do it at least once. Some weeks I'll do it like three times where I'll say, let's talk about this together. Let's process this. When I think about this verse, my mind goes to here. Am I crazy? Does anybody else feel that way too? And then you just put it out there like that. And something about that has been a healthy ingredient. I don't know how to understand that fully, but it's just helped me know what they're thinking, and it helps refocus the attention, and it helps it be really honest, because they're not going to say something that is totally too academic or something like that. And so it keeps the sermon really focused. So it's been a helpful thing. So I've now, you know, depending upon the size of the group, people can't always do that, but it can be done in a more limited way of just a dialogical kind of, you know, you can kind of, without actually asking for them to talk, you can kind of have a similar feeling of conversation. So, you know, you might say something like, some of you are probably feeling this, and if that's where you're at, here's what I would say. Others of you might be sitting there thinking, what in the world does this have to do with that? Well, I've thought about that too, and here's one thought about that. And you can kind of, it's this conversational dynamic to it. It's like you're asking, you're posing the question that you think they might be asking, and then you're answering that question. So that's been something that I actually think has been a blessing, and it's changed the culture of mornings. It's helped the mornings feel more celebratory and more communal. So it's been a fun little season like that.
Yeah, and so are these like rhetorical questions, or are people actually answering you?
No, actually answering them.
Really? Really? Huh.
Yeah, and I didn't know how it'd go, but yeah. With the culture of our church is such that people actually do a great job. I mean, I've got a wonderful church. The Lord's really blessed us. We've got some great people who are really hungry for God's word. And so it is a joy to preach to them. But yeah, I mean, like this last Sunday, we're preaching on Romans 3, 21 to 26, this great paragraph. But I'd already preached on that passage a few years ago as an isolated text.
Yes.
So I'm like, how am I going to approach this? I don't want to skip it. We're going through Romans. So I thought, well, let's take a little different approach and we'll make it a little more dialogical. And I asked one question and I can't remember what it was, but it just got us going. And it was almost like I had to rein it back in because people kept talking. Now, that doesn't happen every time. I've also had the times where you ask a question and just then you realize this isn't a good question. Nobody knows how to answer this. But that was really encouraging. And I thought that's a success, I think, because it shows that they're really engaging with the text. So I don't do that all the time. But in this season, I feel like it's been very edifying.
Wow. Well, that's really surprising. That sounds very exciting and to be honest, I'm jealous about it, that you're able to, A, see your people, B, and then have this back and forth communication, which is something that for all the wonders of podcasts and YouTube videos, et cetera, it's that face-to-face interaction that's good, that the people are hearing, processing, and then even formulating something of a response. That's really wholehearted, or at least whole-minded engagement. So fair play for that.
Sorry to rub it in when you're about to go to a different context like that. Yeah. Believe me, I feel your pain having done 8 months or so of the same thing, but doing both. And that's what I really realized in that process, how different these two things are. And it's really made me more grateful. Once we get through this season, I think we're all going to be more grateful. I mean, I'm grateful for the technology, but I'm grateful when we're not restricted to that, because it is hard. And I don't think that's the way it's supposed to be, that just talking through a camera like that.
Yeah, absolutely. John Stott, in his book Between Two Worlds, I think he speaks a little bit about dialogical preaching. And, you know, he spoke about, you know, even like the African-American preaching tradition that he like observed and was really enthusiastic about, where there is that kind of call and response, or there's that back and forth. But he was saying that all sermons should be dialogical, even if people aren't shouting things back and forth at each other or addressing one another. That kind of, as you were alluding to earlier on, that a good sermon raises a question, piques people's interest, and then causes them to ask something, and then you give the answer from the scripture. So he's a big proponent of dialogical preaching, but I think that his version of it looks different than what you're currently doing, or even the African-American churches that he was referencing.
Yes. But I love what you're saying there, and I love what he's saying, that however it looks, and certainly there's cultural variation in the expression, but however it looks, there's got to be a back and forth. Mm. You're not just up there. Even if all it is you're picking up on the mood of the room, and that influences you, there's got to be that dynamic. That's probably the biggest thing, going back to the very first question, where I've changed, is just learning to speak to the people right where they're at, from your heart and to their heart. And being really clear, you know, don't beat around the bush. Don't be super, super nuanced about everything.
Yeah, yeah.
Take the main idea and just boom, put it right out on the table for everybody to see. And then you're speaking from your heart directly in a vivid way. And there will be that back and forth exchange during the sermon. Hopefully, I mean, of course, if you're just at your computer, you just have to sort of willfully remember the people on the other side.
Yes, yes, yes. Well, and again, that's where I'm at. That's where you have been. And our hearers, you know, if they listen to this in 2027 and they're thinking, what was that all about? You know, but for those of us in this moment, this is a real hot topic, guys. This is a real hot topic.
If I could just say on that, two pastors watching this, keep going. This is a brutal season for preachers, a brutal season for pastors. I would just say the Lord sees the hard work you're doing. His smile is upon those who remain faithfully at their posts despite the difficult circumstances. So just want to encourage pastors to know that the Lord's, to the extent that they are being faithful to their calling, the Lord is smiling upon them and pleased with them, and to be encouraged by that, because this is a really difficult time for pastors.
Yeah, and so many people are disappointed with their pastors these days, kind of as you were even we're in a really polarized time. And so, you know, we're getting a lot of pushback or critique or but yeah, what a great reminder that the Lord is pleased with those that are being faithful to what he's called them to do. Well, hey, so we've been referencing your book, Finding the Right Hill to Die On. It's available from Crossway, and there's a, you know, a rake of other books that you've written as well. And that's all listed on your website, right? GavinOrtland.com, is that right?
That's right, yeah. People could check out the books from there. And I also started a YouTube channel called Truth
I was
Tonight.
Just about to plug it, yeah. So you've got a really great YouTube channel as well. Would you please tell us about it?
Thanks, I jumped the gun there, sorry. Yeah, it's been an interesting experiment engaging in that medium. The heart behind it is there's lots of people who will watch a YouTube video but never read your book or never go to your church. And so it's a focus on apologetics and theology and a few devotional things. And then I especially have had a focus on engaging with Roman Catholics and Eastern Orthodox Christians. So that's been a focus of it as well. So it's called Truth Unites. People could check it out on YouTube.
Yeah, on the one hand, I mean, yeah, I've enjoyed it. I subscribe. I benefit from it. Also, too, as someone serving in a majority Catholic country, I do appreciate the attention that you're giving to those things in a very respectful way. So that's a resource that I'm especially planning on recommending to people when they have questions about differentiation between, you know, Protestant or Catholic doctrine. There's cultural differences that are very big here in Ireland between Catholics and Protestants. And it's not necessarily theological, but yet I have encountered people that are interested in the theology. So that's going to be a useful resource that I can't wait to use here on the ground. But on the one hand, as much as we agree, as hard as it is to preach to a computer, like, you just signed up to do more. Like, you're volunteering for more. You're able to talk to real people, but yet you've chosen to, in addition to that, to also do a YouTube channel. So, like, thank you for your service, man.
Oh, thanks. I hope it's helpful for people. I just think that there's space there where people are there. You know, YouTube is doing nothing but expanding in the midst of the pandemic and everything else. There's people there, but I've just been astonished at how little sort of evangelical Protestant presence there is in relation to Catholic channels, for example, and then apologetics. There's some great apologetics things, but I just see a lot of need there. There's lots of people to be reached, and so the medium there, I think, is just an opportunity, kind of a mission field.
Well, thanks, and we'll have links to all of this in the show notes. Gavin, thank you so very much for your time, and I hope that this episode and all that we do here at the Expositors Collective podcast helps you to grow in your personal study and your public proclamation of God's word. So, thanks, Gavin.
Hey, thanks a lot, Mike. Enjoyed it.
Well, thanks for listening, and I really enjoyed that conversation. So thanks again to Gavin for his time. And as wonderful as it was to speak about preaching and theological triage and dialogical preaching, it was just a real joy to speak about Calvin and Hobbes for a little bit. So, you know what, guys, let me just say this. We have a Facebook group. And you can find the group on facebook.com/groups/expositors collective. And it's kind of a private community where basically every week we do like have little miniature discussions about these podcasts when people are able to ask questions or to get feedback. And if you want to join that, man, we'd love to have you. I realize that, we were just talking about the importance of dialogue, and we would love to dialogue with you about this episode or other episodes of the podcast, or even just conversations about preaching in general. So if you go to facebook.com/groups/expositors collective, there's like some rules for you to agree to. There's some questions, and then you'll get added to the group. And we can just take this conversation to the next level and make it an actual conversation that involves your voice, not just mine. Okay, I'm going to leave you with a teaser clip from next week's podcast, which is a great conversation that I had with Pastor Tony Carter. So I'm going to leave you with this, and I'll see you next Tuesday for the next episode of the Expositors Collective.
Well, I think, probably more than anything, because of the way that sermons by others are so readily available, and the fact that we have a culture where, we kind of lionize certain preachers, and, preachers have large platforms, and we easily can get enamored with, certain preachers. And I think that the biggest pitfall is that young preachers are trying to be people that they're not. Mm-hmm. And so they're trying to imitate the preachers who have big platforms, and almost with the idea that, oh wow, that's how you get to that big platform, rather than being faithful as being the ultimate goal, faithful to God and faithful to use the gifts that God has given you for His glory, wherever that platform might lead. The most difficult thing, I think, is to find your own voice, to find your own voice. Oh. And with so many voices out there, it almost is difficult. But the most faithful preachers are those who find a voice and the experiences that the Lord has given them. And then that voice is preached through those experiences, you know, for the glory of God. Like that's where young preachers probably find the most pitfalls.
Yeah.
And how they have to be encouraged not to.